You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Alexa Datt, and today we are talking Nationals baseball. We bring in Nationals reporter for MLB.com, Jamal Collier. Hey Jamal, happy Thanksgiving. How's everything going?
Great, how are you?
I'm doing all right. It was funny, I was watching MLB Network earlier today, watching the Nationals GM, Mike Rizzo, basically pitch the entire world on why Shohei Ohtani should come to the Nationals. And I know that Ohtani's agent has sent out questionnaires to all 30 MLB teams. Everyone's going to fill one out. But to hear a GM, you know, pitch this international superstar as to why he should come to their team, I thought was pretty interesting. The winning pedigree being the main thing he was talking about. But do you believe that Shohei Ohtani would actually choose the Nationals?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think there's a couple things there. Is that, you know, everybody would be wise to take a shot and kind of make your sales pitch to Ohtani and his agents to say why you want to go out through his services. I've heard a lot about the hype around this particular player. This guy has the ability to potentially pitch and hit, be a two-way player who's going to come at a bit of a discount. He's certainly not a cheap player, but he's certainly somebody you can get a look at or potentially can have on your roster and could be a major piece at a price that's a little bit below the market value that he could get if he was just a regular free agent. So, I mean, the Nats are kind of selling, you know, as far as their team goes. One is a team who obviously has success. You're talking about a team who's automatically joining a World Series contender, and that's just got to be enticing to anybody in general when playing this game. Is that you're going to get on a team that's been to the playoffs for the last 6 years, have a chance to do that again and kind of be set up for the future to make runs at a World Series championship. It's a team who's been able to handle big stars like Bryce Harper and Steven Strasburg. And Rizzo also pointed to an interesting fact that, the much kind of discussed shutdown of Strasburg to be an advantage for him now, because he can let players know, look, I'm going to take care of you despite what the outside criticism or those kind of things might be. That if I think this is in for your best interest, or I think this is to protect your long-term health, it's something that I would do as opposed to just trying to win at all costs. So I think that's kind of the complete package of the Nationals. The other kind of flip side is the Nats in 2016, they went on an international spending kind of spree a little bit, spent a lot of money on the open market, and that's kind of just hampered their, you know, financial freedom right now in international, for signing international players. So they offer Ohtani much money. They are going to pale in comparison to some of the other teams like the Yankees and Rangers. They can offer somewhere around $3 million. They're only somewhere around $300,000 as far as their signing bonus goes. And that's going to be kind of a tough thing to overcome. So they're going to have to count on Ohtani, not just necessarily looking for money, looking for maybe the best kind of package, and that can kind of compete better in some of those other ways.
The other thing that Mike Rizzo pointed out was that he was happy with the top four starters and also noted that you can never have enough good starting pitching. And listen, I know they got Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, Gio Gonzalez, and Tanner Roark. They're looking for a fifth guy to really solidify this rotation. They're talking about a potential reunion with Jordan Zimmermann. How would you believe that could play out?
Yeah, I mean, the Nats are a team that still they've been built on pitching, and through this run we talked about of success they've had, starting pitching has been a major part of it. And it's obviously when you've got those two guys, those top four are as good as anybody in baseball, especially the two guys at the top when you get Max and Steven Strasburg both healthy. So it's always when you have those names out there and you have big name starting pitching, the Nats are always sort of kind of lurking in the background. It's not a team necessarily that just spends freely, but at the same time, we saw it before when they didn't appear to have a pitching opening before they signed Max Scherzer. They went out, they signed a guy because they knew Jordan Zimmermann was going to be a free agent the next year. And similar things with Gio Gonzalez right now, where Gio is going to be on the last year of his deal. So maybe you sign his replacement a year ahead of time. I still think that I would be surprised if they go for one of those kind of top-end starters that we see right now, the guy like your Darvish or Jake Arrieta or so. I think they are pretty comfortable staying away from net bidding. Unless things kind of progress through the offseason, then they can potentially get them at a discount. But, you know, I think they're going to go for some guys who have some depth, maybe some experience. They've got a couple minor league prospects they've kind of liked. A.J. Cole took a pretty big step forward last year. Eric Fetty, still their top pitching prospect. So I think that the combination of those things, I would be more surprised if they went after kind of another home run top of the rotation starter and try to find a guy who can just kind of be steady and can make you 30, 35 starts and really give it a good mix of depth That's one thing they don't really have a whole lot. They maybe have, you know, four or five or six guys they like. But when you talk about needing seven or eight or nine starting pitchers to get through an entire season, I'm not sure they're there just yet.
Last but not least, what Rizzo said, I think also on MLB Network, surprised me and a lot of Nationals fans, I would assume, that he's not convinced that Bryce Harper is going to leave via free agency next winter. And listen, barring the signing of an extension at some point before next winter, he becomes a free agent and could go make huge, huge buku bucks somewhere else. Do you believe that there's a chance that he stays in D.C.?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think he generally likes D.C. a lot. And just from talking to him and people around him, I think that first part, he just really enjoys the city and enjoys playing with the Nationals. And I think that that's going to be obviously the team that he came up with, the organization. He's only the only organization he's ever known. That's still a pretty major selling point. I think that the Nationals continue to prove that they're on the verge of winning and being in a World Series and continue showing that they're going to be a title contender that's constantly going to put, you know, the pieces around him to keep winning. You know, it's just pretty much everything else that he pretty much wants. It's a place that he's comfortable in, a place he's going to be able to win. And, of course, then the money has to be there. I think that's another indication that I think some people have been a little skeptical with the Nationals maybe. Will they match in the end there? But, you know, Rizzo seems to be still pretty comfortable that he can make a real run at Bryce, have a chance to re-sign him, even if he does hit free agency next year before they get an extension agreed to. But no, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that Bryce is gone. I think that the Nats still have as good a case as anybody because they've got one of those similar things that everybody else kind of can pitch to Bryce. They've got it as well, and they can also kind of have a place that he's comfortable with.
What's the latest on Dave Martinez, Chip Hale, and these new guys who have come in and are going to be on the bench? What can Nationals fans expect, and what are the team expecting from this new group of coaches?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's they all kind of got together for the first time right before the holidays, and I think just kind of starting to formulate just a plan or just some of the things that they really want to emphasize going forward, I think was kind of the biggest key I've gotten out of that meeting. Nothing necessarily major or different from when they all first got signed. But I think now it's kind of a process of kind of getting to know each other, making sure they have the right personnel in place to do some of the things that they want to do when the season begins. So I'm interested to see, once they all get together, we'll probably see some of them at the winter meetings here in a couple of weeks, especially Dave Martinez has got to have his first kind of reintroduction to everybody after his first press conference. So, so far, like I said, everything's kind of quiet and looks good on the manager coaching search front for the Nats right now. They feel pretty good about the staff they put together.
Jason Worth not expected to return to the Nationals. Do you think that there's a chance that his, career, especially in Washington, is over, and especially in terms of them having a spot for him and a position on the team?
Yeah, I would be surprised. I think from the beginning, I've kind of said I would be pretty surprised if Worth finds his way back. Now, I know both sides continue to say they haven't closed the book on that. They're still open to seeing what they can get, but the Nats already have kind of an overload of outfielders. A lot of them are young. A lot of them are in their prime. A lot of them are going to cost less than Jason Woodlatch. So I would be surprised if they could find something out. If they did work something out, it'd probably be some kind of bench role definitely reduced playing time from what Worth was at last year. And I just I don't know. I think he still can find another spot somewhere in the American League, especially where he can play the field and DH, where he could probably get more playing time. Probably could earn even more money and have just a more of a guaranteed spot. And again, I just look at the way that they treated Jason kind of at the end of the season there, the tribute videos, the walk-offs, those kind of things that he had there. This is not normally something you do for a guy that you're, pretty sure you're going to be able to re-sign. So I think just the signs are on the wall that Worth probably his Nats career is done. But we've seen crazier things happen before here at the last minute in free agency, so I don't think I'd 100% rule it out just yet.
Yeah, you better believe it. How about in their bullpen? Brandon Kinsler was such a huge addition for this team. If the right-hander ends up signing elsewhere, where do you think the Nationals are going to be able to find a reliable bullpen arm this winter?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one thing, too, that's probably the toughest thing for GMs to evaluate, right? If they're good, when you're their suspect, when you're you just never kind of know what you get. That's why the guys who have been consistent and have pitched well over multiple reliefs for years seem to get so much money nowadays. So I think that, they're going to look everywhere. It's kind of it's kind of their thing about looking about diligence and trying to see exactly where they can go, whether it be the free agent market, trade market, see what they have internally they feel like can help next year. But I think, you know, that bullpen depth would be probably for me one of the top priorities for this team, is that, you know, they've got Gosdien and Madsen and Doolittle, who you finally feel comfortable about. And that just makes it a little bit easier, too, to kind of just build the rest of your pen when you already have, you know, the eighth and ninth inning figured out, which has kind of not been the norm for the Nats over the last couple of years. It feels like they're always trying to figure out who exactly is going to be in that closer spot. So, yeah, I think that one thing, when having those guys at the end, is going to make it, you know, a little bit more, should be less painful of a process for the Nats fans this year as they try to build out a bullpen.
All right, Jamal, the offseason is young. Plenty more can happen, and we'll have you on weekly to discuss exactly what this Nationals team is going to look like as we get closer to spring training. But really appreciate you joining us this week. Everyone, make sure to go follow Jamal on Twitter, and we'll catch up next week. Thanks, Jamal.
No problem. Anytime.
Talk soon. Hey, everyone. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. We're talking Mets baseball today, and we bring in our Mets.com reporter, Anthony DiComo. DiComo, how you feeling? How's everything going?
Going well. How are you?
Good. Just kind of recovering from Thanksgiving. A little bit of turkey and stuffing hangover. But, hey, we're back in the baseball game. That's what I like. Let's talk a little bit about some reports recently with the Mets. Considering a deal to land Adam Lind, after Sandy Alderson says that Dominic Smith would have to win the first base job. What's the latest here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thinking is kind of unchanged from when the Mets went into the offseason, and we knew they were going to look at guys like Adam Lind, Logan Morrison, I think, fits into that category, a couple of others. You know, they want guys who can play first base but who also have a little bit of flexibility to play elsewhere. And the reason is largely because they don't know what they're going to get from Dominic Smith. You know, he had a chance last August, last September, to debut and to blow them away and to kind of put to bed all those questions about his conditioning and about his ability to hit for power and about whatever. And he didn't do any of it, really. You know, he came in from the minors, certainly having gained a little weight from where he was in spring training, where he had looked great. He did hit for power at the big leagues, but he didn't really hit for a lot else. His defense, which had been a hallmark of his game throughout his minor league career, really suffered at the big league level. So he certainly didn't just take the job and run with it. And he put the Mets in a position where they are very hesitant and will not just say Dominic Smith is our first baseman. Now, answering people's tweets, and we did an inbox this week and I answered a question about this, I think people are mistaking this as the Mets have given up on Dominic Smith. This one-time top prospect is no longer in their plans. That's not the case at all. He's still very much in their plans. He could still potentially come into spring training, even if the Mets do sign a first base type this winter, and win the job. And that's part of the reason why they want someone like an Adam Lind with flexibility, someone who can play the outfield potentially if Mike Conforto is not ready to go on opening day, someone who doesn't necessarily have to gobble up all of the at-bats at first base if Dominic Smith does prove over the offseason that he has improved, that he's dropped some weight, that he's looking good, that he's ready to go as a big league first baseman. You know, there are a lot of moving parts here, and I think certainly the Mets are right in that they're going around and shopping for someone who can play first base, but it's really not a condemnation of long-term Dominic Smith. What it is an acknowledgement that, you know, this guy has not won the everyday job yet and is not, at this point, the Mets' everyday first baseman.
How, at this point, is it possible in 2017 for a player to struggle with their weight? With everything that's available, all the resources that are available at their fingertips, whether it's a nutritionist or a trainer, that they can still struggle to, you know, have any sort of issues with their conditioning?
Yeah, you know, it's a long season, particularly in the minor leagues. And one of the things that I thought was interesting that Dominic Smith said about at the end of the season was he said, well, now that I'm up in the big leagues, it's going to be a lot easier. And what you need to understand is that, you know, these guys have late night flights and bus rides, and they're in these small towns where oftentimes the only place you can go to eat that's open is a fast food restaurant and things of that nature. They don't have these fancy kitchen staff and nutritionists and everything that you have at the big league level. So it's a lot more difficult to do when you're coming up through the system. And some guys, you know, just because they're professional athletes, doesn't mean, you know, they're all the fittest people on earth. You know, some people struggle with this more than others. And Dominic Smith, obviously, throughout his career, this has been a question about him since the day he was drafted. He's obviously had a tougher time with it than a lot of people do. So, you know, the hope is that what he did last offseason when he came in, he dropped, I want to say, about 30 pounds coming into spring training, wound up putting a bunch of it back on during the season. But the hope is that he can take what he did last offseason and kind of further it and replicate it, but then also hold on to those gains. And if he is going to be at the big league level full-time starting in April, that he can use those resources that you talked about at his disposal, that he can use the kitchen staff and the nutrition staff and the training staff. The Mets are making a point this winter to hire more people to their training staff in an effort to be a little more proactive about those sorts of wellness things, not just eating and nutrition, but rest and the way in which guys work out between games and so on and so forth, so that he can maintain a healthy weight throughout the season. I think it is something that's difficult for him, but it's not an obstacle that he cannot overcome.
All right, let's move on to second base, where the Mets have an opening. There's obviously a list of possibilities out there. Mets have had talks with the Tigers on a deal for Ian Kinsler, possibly the four-time All-Star second baseman. What are the chances you believe Ian Kinsler plays for the Mets next year?
I think it's slim. I think any trade for a really big name like that is going to be tough for the Mets to pull off, because there's going to be competition, and frankly, the Mets don't have a ton of prospects that are going to interest other teams, and you know, short of that, you pay a little more so you don't have to give up good prospects. Well, the Mets don't have the appetite to take on a ton of payroll where they can sort of discount what they're giving to other teams. So, you know, they will add a second baseman at some point. I'm not sure it will come via trade. It could come via free agency. Neil Walker is another name that has popped up, and certainly Mets fans are very familiar with him. But it is a hole they have to fill, and I think what we've seen from some of these rumors who have come out early in the offseason is that the Mets, as they have said publicly, seem like they're pretty committed to acquiring a second baseman instead of a third baseman. And they had Asdrubal Cabrera, who could go either way. Asdrubal Cabrera will start somewhere in the infield, and the thought at the end of the season was, well, maybe he could play second, and they would acquire a third baseman. But it looks like the opposite is going to happen. It looks like Asdrubal will be the everyday third baseman, and the Mets will acquire a second baseman. Will it be Ian Kinsler? He's a fit. Certainly he's the type of player that the Mets would like, with that little bit of power over there at second base. They've always kind of gravitated towards players of that nature. But will it be him specifically? I think it's going to be difficult for the Mets to swing a deal that's appetizing both to them and to the Tigers. It's going to be potentially a longer process at second base, I think, you know, as opposed to maybe relief pitching, where the Mets are going to want to strike quickly, maybe even for that first base market we just talked about, where they're going to potentially want to strike quickly. I think second base could potentially drag out a little bit. There are some interesting options. There are some flawed options. I'm not sure there's this one perfect option out there that the Mets are really going to put all their resources into to try and acquire. So it's going to be interesting to see this unfold. But, yeah, I think it's pretty clear at this point that second base is a priority for them.
You mentioned Neil Walker, the 32-year-old. He accepted that qualifying offer from the Mets before last season. The two sides tried to work towards an extension that never really picked back up in terms of momentum, and then he was obviously traded in August to the Brewers. A reunion would be good for the Mets, do you believe? Or do you believe there are still some things that would hang up that deal, potentially injuries or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the million-dollar question. If you knew that Neil Walker would be healthy, I think certainly a reunion would be good for the Mets. But he is getting a little older, a little up there in age. He has had those pretty major back problems, which is always something that is going to scare off prospective teams. And I think the other thing you kind of hinted at it there with the contract extension, you know, Neil Walker is the kind of guy who has always liked the idea of planting his roots somewhere. He tried to work out a long-term deal with Pittsburgh early in his career, where he was from. And I think, you know, in a perfect world for him, he never would have left the Pirates. He would have been born and raised and retired there in Pittsburgh. It didn't work out. And once he came to New York and really liked it, it was close to home. It was a market that maybe he didn't consider in the past something that he would have enjoyed, but he did enjoy it. And as you mentioned, there were some preliminary talks about a potential extension, and that didn't work out either. So I'm not sure Neil Walker is going to be super thrilled with the idea of maybe taking a one-year deal somewhere. Of I think he's the kind of guy who kind of wants to set his roots and maybe sign a contract and know where he's going to be for a few years. And I don't know if the Mets are going to be willing to do that. But if you just talk about the player in a bubble and what he could bring, obviously, you know, hits for a nice average, plays some decent defense, hits for good power from the second base position. The Mets know what Neil Walker is about on the field. They, since day one, they loved his leadership aspect in the clubhouse. They loved the way he integrated himself really as the new guy in town on a veteran team at the time. He did well for himself, and I think he's the type of player, he's exactly the type of player the Mets need. But there are, as you said, significant questions about his health, and ultimately that could derail a deal.
Let's move on to the bullpen. Obviously, the Mets need to add a few pieces there, especially if they're going to have a strong and healthy rotation in 2018. Who do you believe that's out there right now could be a good fit for their pen?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the relief market, I see, you know, one distinct top tier. And that's Greg Holland and Wade Davis, two guys who are going to want to be closers somewhere. And I don't think the Mets are going to be in on either of those guys. But then you look at that second tier, guys like Brandon Morrow, guys like Brian Shaw. There's a whole bunch of them. You could go six or seven deep. That's a market that the Mets traditionally have not dabbled in, because these are guys who profile as setup men. And Addison Reed type, for example, is another name. Guys who are going to get 3, maybe even 4-year deals on the open market. And Sandy Alderson and the Mets have for years had a strong belief that they're just not worth it, that the nature of relief pitching is very fickle. You don't really know what guys are going to do from year to year like you do at other positions. And so they've avoided that, and they've tried to build their bullpens on the cheap. And I think if you break down some of the things that Sandy Alderson and that his assistant, John Rico, have said this offseason, even some of the comments that Mickey Callaway, the new manager, has made, is that the Mets realize that the game has changed and that these relief pitchers are very, very important. And especially with the way the Mets are talking about working their starting rotation, not letting pitchers face the batting order the third time through, you're going to need some durable, dependable, really, really good relievers. So I think, you know, if there's one place this offseason that the Mets are really going to splash and really kind of exceed expectations in terms of what they're going after, it would be the bullpen. And I do expect them to get someone in that second tier. Brian Shaw is a name that has come up again and again and again, obviously familiar with the Indians, with Mickey Callaway. But it could be a Brandon Morrow. It could be a reunion with Addison Reed. It could be a Juan Nicasio. Or there's any number of names in that second tier that are really, really good pitchers. And I think certainly the Mets will sign one of them. I think they're going to talk to the representatives for just about all of them, and we'll see where it ends up. But if you pair, you know, a minimum of one of those guys with Dries Familia, A.J. Ramos, and Jerry Blevins at the back end, all of a sudden you've got a pretty good foundation back there, which is something the Mets really didn't have going into 2017.
All right, how about a player that will definitely be with the Mets next year? And the latest on Michael Conforto is positive news, which is good, recovering from that left shoulder surgery that he had there in September. He should be swinging a bat by late January. I mean, fans have been freaking out waiting to hear what's going to happen with Michael Conforto. It sounds like he's going to be good to go for spring training. Do you see any limits to him, potentially for opening day or early in the season?
Yeah, I mean, I would still be surprised at this point if he's ready for opening day. And frankly, anyone, you know, who can say one way or the other right now as we stand here in November is lying. It's going to be impossible to tell where he is at until he really ramps it up in February and even into March. You know, it's possible he's ready to go. He's there. I think the Mets should and will err on the side of caution. And, you know, that could mean maybe the first half of April he's on the disabled list. And then when he comes back, he's at full strength. And that's kind of the idea, is you don't want him – you don't want this surgery recovery to be something that stays with Michael Conforto all season. When he comes back, you want him to be back for good, and you don't have to worry about it ever again. That was the point of getting the surgery, was that he you don't have to worry about this. He's going in, he's getting it fixed, and it's something that shouldn't bother him going forward. So if that means costing him a few days in April, certainly the Mets will take that. Any progress he's making at this point is of course good news, and we're just going to have to wait and be patient and see where he is come, say, March 1st when he's in Grapefruit League games, March 15th. Those are going to be the real important tests, because you can do all you want in a gym. You can do all you want in a physical therapy center. Until you get out there and start doing things at game speed against live competition, there's really nothing you can do as a player to prepare for that.
Yeah, sounds good. Even though it's early news, it's still good news, and especially having to do anything with the health of their players, Mets fans are happy to hear that. Anthony DiComo, thanks so much for joining us this week. Enjoy, and we will check in next week. Any sort of rumors, you can check him out on Twitter, follow him there, and he will keep you up to date on all things going on with the Mets. Hey everyone, welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Alexa Datt, and today we're talking Marlins baseball, and we bring in our Marlins reporter for MLB.com, Joe Fusaro. Joe, the Marlins have been the talk of the offseason. With the winter meetings just around the corner, they could potentially be the belle of the ball from December 10th to the 14th down there in Orlando. The latest sources are saying that Giancarlo Stanton's camp has given the Marlins a list of teams where he would accept a trade. The Dodgers are potentially the highest on that list. What do you make of this list, and what do you make of Giancarlo Stanton's wishes to go play for the Dodgers?
Well, it's the time of year to make lists, right? The naughty nice and all that other good stuff. So might as well have the Stanton list. I think it kind of makes a lot of sense that the Los Angeles Dodgers would be very high on the priority if Stanton were to be moved from Miami, which it appears is going to happen. And the Dodgers, I find the most fascinating team in this whole mix, because that's home to Stanton. He grew up, his dad, when Big G was just a little guy, although he's probably a big kid even little. They go. Stanton's dad would always take him to Dodger Stadium, especially when the power hitters of that era were coming through, and he just kind of watched the greatest sluggers the game had to offer at Dodger Stadium, as well as obviously the great Dodger teams or so that he would have been subjected to watching too as a kid. And I could see that would make so much sense on practicality. He's from there. He certainly has Hollywood written all over him. And the question is, do the Dodgers want to make it work? I've seen reports about, they're kind of pushing up against the luxury tax, which obviously is a big concern, but, that's a team with a ton of revenue, and this is a generational home run hitter who I personally think, if he gets in the right environment, based on the amount of home runs he's hit before age 27 or at age 27, this guy is going to be a 500-600 home run guy who's going to, put himself in a Hall of Fame, category. And I think his legacy is big, and I think the Dodgers would be an amazing fit for him if they choose to go that way. But you see teams there, the contract scares people away, the opt-out, the no trade clause. There's a lot of factors that go into it. Do they want to go over the luxury tax and pay the penalty? I think at the end of the day, we're kind of losing sight that this is a remarkable player, Alexa, who has kind of figured it out, and he stayed healthy for the first time, which is huge. He kind of knew what it took, how to play at a pace, how to condition himself. And to be honest with you, obviously as a physical specimen, Stanton kind of stands alone in the league anyway, but he did look a little leaner, a little more limber, and, he was able to, hold up a whole year. And the 59 homers aren't an accident. That's a huge number. He scored 123 runs. I was kind of cracked up at this time of year hearing people always convincing themselves why they don't want a player. And if a guy didn't build a case that you would want this guy, it's certainly the Cardinals seem to be the most vocal, and they're not shooting down, they're running away from it. They kind of, I think, recognize that maybe this guy's figured it out, and he's entering his prime, and he's in remarkable shape, and if this guy can hold up, we could see a very special player. So, you're right. He's holding up a lot of the offseason. Certainly, the secondary moves the Marlins will make. And if it's the Dodgers, I think it would probably be a dream come true for Stanton. The question is, do the Dodgers see it as a dream come true for them?
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the luxury tax. Like you mentioned, the Dodgers are up against it. But what would the Dodgers give the Marlins in return if they are able to trade for Giancarlo Stanton?
Yeah, I mean, this is always getting back to, you know, how much money would the Marlins take off their hands? I would think the Dodgers have a deep enough system that, you know, they'll get a player or two that's pretty high profile. Do the Marlins have to take on a bad contract? I see it more prospects, Alexis, rather than, I know people here would automatically in Miami say Puig, because, you know, that's a, you know, Cuban-born player to come to Miami who is certainly entertaining and talented. I'm not sure, and I know Puig and Mattingly, there's all that they didn't get along very well. But, you know, both have kind of changed in a couple of years removed from being together. So I'm just not sure Puig is the player the Marlins want, meaning that, you know, here's a guy that could be getting closer to free agency. Do they really, you know, feel that they want a younger guy that more controllable for more years, or do they want to try to be as competitive as possible? And, you know, Puig could be kind of an entertaining guy to have here. So that would be the interesting thing to see. But and everyone kind of assumes, obviously, the Marlins need young pitching and frontline pitching. And Stanton, Ozuna and company are probably their best bet to get it via trade. I don't necessarily think that the Marlins for Stanton, because of all the money attached and the years and the complexity of his contract, I think they take the best players they could get if one or two are pitchers, but not, you know, the next Kershaw. You know, I think they can live with that.
So we're talking about Giancarlo Stanton's list. I'd be interested to see where the Cardinals and Giants fall on that list, because two teams who are very interested in Stanton right now, two teams who, you know, have had, you know, winning pedigree in the past and who are, you know, turning the corner, hoping to get that back in both of those franchises. I know Giancarlo Stanton wants to win right now. If you had to guess where those two teams fall on his list, what would you say?
I'd say he has an open mind. And I will say this, Alexa, and I kind of heard this through the grapevine, that apparently in July, when the Marlins are kind of keeping Stanton informed of teams that were calling on him, clearly they weren't looking to move him at the time, and they kind of said so because they were still, you know, in the hot process of selling the team, that Stanton balked at both the Giants and the Cardinals. Now, say that indeed happened, I could see that being a guy kind of caught in the middle of the season, not really thinking it out. You know, just kind of my feel, knowing Giancarlo a long time. He's very thoughtful. He's going to give this. I know he's probably considering his legacy. Where's the best fit, best chance to win, chance to be comfortable in all those things. He's probably doing his due diligence. If he is open to St. Louis, and I'm not convinced he's not, I think that might be the best fit for him. I think that team is most of the teams that have been mentioned. Now, there could be, you know, we discussed the Yankees and that dream scenario of that lineup if Stanton was in it. But we don't know that the Yankees are there. Apparently, the Yankees, they want Ohtani. They want to wait a year on Harper or Machado, which I don't understand the waiting year, you know, mindset when you're, you know, you never know what's going to happen a year from now. I think of the teams we have now, I think the Cardinals would be the best fit for him. And I'm not convinced he'd say no.
Yeah, that could be pretty interesting, especially because, you know, he hasn't sniffed the playoffs in his career, and he's been on, you know, teams who have not done and performed well. And so for him to get a taste of the postseason with a team that, you know, I believe is ready to get back into that postseason form could be, you know, a good fit for him. But I don't know if they're there right now. And, you know, Cardinals fans could argue with me, that's fine. But you would assume that where he is right now and you know, where he's come from, that he is ready to win a ring today. And he would want to join the team that is 100% ready to win today. And I don't know that the Cardinals give him the best opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I agree. If you wanted to specifically make it that, but clearly if you go to St. Louis, if it's a two-year process, I mean, to me, the two teams are the Yankees and the Dodgers. If you want to, if he goes to either of those two teams, right? What do you think when we're all asked to do our preseason prediction, who's going to World Series?
Right.
You know, both of those teams are right there. If not, you know, the Astros will be dethroned by one of them. You know, that would kind of be kind of the thought process. So, yeah, you're right. But, you know, keep this in mind, too. Stanton was patient in Miami thinking that, you know, hoping that the Marlins were going to put him in position. You know, everyone makes a big deal about how backloaded Stanton's contract was. Well, you know, part of that was big design too, because at the time when he signed that extension after the 14th season, the Marlins weren't there yet, and they had some players coming to the forefront. By him taking backloaded, they were able to sign Yelich. You know, they were able to sign D. Gordon eventually. You know, it gave them the money to get some players. So the Cardinals are clearly, you know, apparently have a big TV deal coming in where more money's being influxed into that organization. And the way they build, I'm sure it's not going to take very long. You know, whether that's immediate or not. And I also think people tell me there's no way he would ever opt out. But I could see him, let's say, going to the Giants and giving it a chance with Posey and Crawford and see if they could, and Bruce Bochy and Bumgarner figuring out how to make it work in the next 3 years. I could see him, if he's putting up big numbers, opting out at age 30, because I think at age 30, Stanton can still beat a $218 million contract for 7 years.
So we've mentioned four teams, the Giants, the Cardinals, the Yankees, and the Dodgers. Of the teams we have not mentioned, who do you believe is potentially a dark horse landing spot for Stanton?
That's a really good one. Let me think real fast. I think Arizona, potentially. I think San Diego, because of that market. L.A., Angels, you know, whether the Angels want to go that route and try to have a Trout-Stanton outfield. Obviously, they got Pujols. They got a lot of money there, and they need pitching. Those are a few teams that could come to mind.
Man, could you imagine him playing with Mike Trout and the two of them taking over and finally getting over their postseason woes and sniffing the postseason and tasting the postseason together?
Yeah, I mean, that, again, we kind of did it with the Yankees, doing the lineup. We do the mock lineup, however you want to do it. Trout, Stanton, Pujols, or whatever. I know, I guess they're very right-handed oriented, but I don't care. Those are, let's see, how many home runs you got there? You got 30, 60, 30, or 40? if you add them up, you know, from three guys, you know, I'll stay right-handed dominant if those are the three.
Yeah. All right. Well, teams can dream all day long, but it'll be interesting to see when it finally does come down to the decision what Stanton decides. Let's talk about some other players who are drawing into interest. How about D. Gordon? Stolen base leader for the third time in four seasons. You know, he adds speed and an incredible weapon to any team. Which teams are interested in D. Gordon right now?
Well, the Blue Jays are doing their due diligence right now. They're acquiring, they're you know, checking in with Marlins. They're doing background checks to see, you know, if they feel D would be a good fit for them. You know, it had been reported a week or so ago, a possible package deal, Stanton and Gordon to the Giants. I'm not sure if that's practical with the Giants, you know, already. If they get Stanton, if they get those two, from what I was told, it'd be $35 million over the luxury tax. And that's, you know, I guess you subtract if Panic, let's say, came back to the Marlins as part of that trade. He's in arbitration, so it'd be minus whatever Panic would make. And so you're still looking at $30, $35 million over the tax for a team that, you know, has holes. So I don't necessarily see that scenario. I could see independently possibly Gordon going there, but, you know, I know the Mets and some teams have you know, that with second base needs. I know, a year or so ago, the Phillies, but I think the Phillies have a pretty good second base prospect. But I would say the Blue Jays are a team to keep an eye on for D. Gordon.
I've also heard the Marlins listening to offers for Marcell Ozuna, and I know he's not a free agent until 2020. Is there a chance that he's moved this offseason?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, there's no urgency to move him, but, you know, if you're gonna make moves and kind of move your big guy in Stanton, then you're certainly going to be open to moving Ozuna. I would say they'd be open to moving Yelich. I mean, I could see them being open to moving literally everyone on the roster if something made sense. Now, keep in mind, you know, that there's no urgency, and they can, you know, completely get the deal they want. You know, if you're going to move Ozuna, you know, you better get that. That's the guy that's probably going to net you your next ace or number two starter, as well as maybe starting shortstop, you know, and some organizational depth, you know. So, you know, that guy's going to pull a lot of players in for you, the same with Yelich. So that's one reason, you know, there are a lot of teams that, you know, with the Astros, when they stripped it down and built up, it's like the Marlins kind of right now have more than those type teams did to get to where they are. So if they strategically play their hands and move these guys, they could get the kind of haul that would, you know, kind of make the rebuild not last as long as, you know, the previous one.
You mentioned that if the Cardinals don't land Stanton, that Ozuna is a potential fit there. You also talked about the Cardinals having talks with the Marlins about Brad Zegler and how interested they could be in him. Do you see him being moved?
Yeah, I mean, if that's $9 million for a 38-year-old who had his struggles, you know, this year in 17. So the Cardinals are definitely interested, and if there's a market for him, whether that could be a potential Stanton-Ziegler deal or, you know, Ozuna, Stanton, let's say, goes to San Francisco, is it Ozuna, Ziegler, or, you know, I could see him attached to a trade, or, you know, if the Cardinals, I don't think the Marlins get the return because they'd be moving the money, but I think the Cardinals see that style of pitcher being used effectively and against certain hitters being a big bullpen piece for them. So, I'm sure the Marlins will be happy if a few more teams jump in the mix. So, you know, they got about 9 guys that are under contract for $130 million next year. So I think any bites on any of those guys, a couple of them are going to find a substantial part of next year, so they're not going to get any hits on them. But, you know, the same would hold true for a Prado or whatever. If someone is interested, they certainly hope to listen and engage them.
All right, Joe, and finally, I know Giancarlo Stanton's name is the biggest right now in trade talks, but in terms of free agency, it's Shohei Ohtani's name who has been dominating the headlines. How big of a dark horse do you believe the Marlins are for Ohtani's services?
Well, I kind of threw it out there in an inbox and another story about it could be fascinating. The Marlins are looking to increase their international presence. You know, they're trying to build, you know, obviously, I think the way they look at our proximity in South Florida to Latin America and Dominican Republic, Venezuelan talent, Puerto Rican talent, you know, that they could go in and get more players than they have in the past, not because people in the past did a bad job, but they didn't allocate the resources. Is there a better, if the Marlins are going to move the most popular player, one of their most popular players in history in Stanton, and you're in the fan base that's sitting here going, now what? What a bigger name than Shohei Ohtani for the Marlins in statement internationally than to go get him. And, you know, as I kind of spelled out, it's a little different than when Ichiro hit the market at age 27 and ready to win right now and was an MVP and Rookie of the Year in 2001 in Seattle. Ohtani is 23, and we still don't know what he can do. We know he's fascinating because he can pitch and hit. But at 23, if he goes to the Yankees, his expectation day one is to be a star. And he's also on the team with Judge and Sanchez and all that comes with the Yankees. And if he fails, you know, there's no breathing room. They're trying to go to the playoffs and go deep into the playoffs. He goes to Miami, they can figure out what he wants to do. Does he want to pitch? Do you want to hit? He'll be the face of the franchise. You surround him with some good young players. And in a couple of years, when those guys grow, you might have one of the most exciting young teams in baseball right here in Miami. And people might be talking here like they're doing in Houston, you know, right now. In a couple of years, it could be Miami's story. So I know the Marlins have shown interest or not basically closing the door. I also know they didn't extensively scout him in the previous regime. But if the new regime, you know, with the slate being wiped clean, if they want to seriously take a look, he's affordable. They just have to make a sales pitch to say, you know, Miami, you know, grow with us, you know, figure out who you are. You won't have the pressure of having to win day one. And you could kind of be the face of the franchise. And, you know, and we'll see one of the more fascinating players to come around in a long time. So, and at the end of the day, for all the problems the Marlins have had, Miami's not that bad a place to live. So, you know, I think that's a pretty good sales pitch as well.
Man, I could just picture right now all these Marlins fans taping over their Stanton jerseys with Ohtani, and both the sadness and the joy that would come with that would be a roller coaster of emotions, I'm telling you, Joe. All right, anyway,
well,
we appreciate you joining us.
Throw them all out there and see what sticks,
what
right?
What sticks, that's right. Yeah, that's what this is all about, especially ahead of winter meetings. Appreciate you joining us, Joe. We'll talk next week. Thank you.
Okay, Alexa, have a good one.
Talk soon. Hey, everyone. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Alexa Datt, and today we're talking Braves baseball. We bring in our Braves reporter for MLB.com, Mark Bowman. Hey, Mark. How's it going?
Hey, Alexa. Great. Starting to feel like a normal offseason. Well,
you know, the start of a normal offseason. Let's put it that way.
Well, yeah, because once you had all of these sanctions being handed down, in this whole situation, the Braves lose 13 prospects. Their former GM is banned for life. And, you know, it's all because they circumvent these international signing rules. I mean, can you tell us what's been the reaction from the team or the buzz around the team about these sanctions?
You know, I think that let's go all the way back to late September. And you felt like there was you didn't know exactly what was about to hit the Braves. And I don't even want to act like I had any clue that I knew the magnitude. But you knew there were some. You know, at that point in time, you know, there were some accusations of tampering against John Coppolella. There were some teams that were certainly upset with. You're hearing some rumblings here and there. We weren't hearing specifically anything about the international market. I knew it might be an interesting offseason. When John Coppolella left Miami on that Saturday, the last Saturday of the regular season, my assumption was maybe he was heading for a suspension at that point in time, but obviously 2 days later, the tone of this offseason was set when we learned that you know, he was forced to resign in the midst of this investigation that led to these, you know, unprecedented set of penalties, like for, you know, like you said, the circumvention of international rules and also some questionable acts within the domestic draft. So, you know, there was so much uncertainty throughout October, and you had Perry Manassian and Adam Fisher, who had been brought over, had just started on September 19th. They were basically put in charge of running the daily operations while John Hart still had a job throughout October, and he was very involved in the interview process of hiring the next GM. You always had a sense that the shoe was going to drop on him, too. I mean, there was no way that Coppy was going to be blamed for everything without John Hart shouldering some blame. And as the month went on, you started to hear more and more from people saying, look, there's some links and all that kind of stuff. So it just was so much uncertainty because you had these two guys who hadn't even been in the organization until September 19th. We're basically trying to run the show. There was coaching changes that were made. Now, granted, John Hart had us playing that. He getting rid of Eddie Perez and Terry Pendleton, bringing in Walt Weiss and Eric Young Sr. I don't want to say these guys worked alone, but it was so unique. And then all of a sudden, Alex Anthopoulos is hired. And as expected, Alex has started to put together his staff with guys that he knows. He didn't really know Adam Fisher. Perry was in his wedding. He worked together with the Blue Jays. Just so happened that Perry had gotten the job here in Atlanta long before Alex even thought that the Braves were even a possibility. So so here you are now. Alex is putting his staff together. Adam Fisher's gone. Perry and Alex are together. And here we are a few days before December, and it feels like maybe what it normally would have near the end of October, as the World Series is in, and you're kind of saying, okay, now which direction is this team going to go? And they could go a number of different ways. And right now, I think they're still feeling out the process. We could sit there and say these are their needs, but at the same time, until we start hearing from agents and other teams about what the Braves are calling and asking about, we really don't know which direction they're going. And right for right now, from what I can understand, is yes, there's some activity, but not a lot of it.
A lot of analysts agreed that the Braves had the top farm system before these sanctions were handed down. Where do you believe it ranks now?
You know what? I'd say it's definitely still top five. And really, if you look at the top 30 prospects, they really only lost Kevin Maiton and Gutierrez, the catcher. Maiton ranked fifth in our rankings, and Gutierrez 30th. Here's what I'd say, though. Instead of just looking at those rankings, you have to look at the farm system as a whole. And anytime you take 13 players away and you're getting zero value in return, you have to say that farm system was severely weak. And so to simply look at the top 30, I think it's your and how many players were lost, I think you're only you're not
evaluating, providing a full assessment of the damage with these punishments, because once you take that depth away, over the next few years, as you start to evaluate, can we make this trade, can we make that trade, you know, the more pieces you have in place, that might provide more options for you. You know, from an immediate standpoint, you know, the difficulty is, okay, now you have to find players to fill some up, you know, some of those roles or those just roster spots that these teams, these players would have filled next year. You look at it and you say, okay, it probably was going to be another 3 or 4 years before any of them made the reached Atlanta. You know, these are all 16, 17-year-old kids for the most part. You know, and so maybe you're looking at 4 or 5 years down the road. But within that process, you had currency. You spent $15 million on these players that were basically taken away from you without you getting any value in return. That is an impact, and that's going to impact them for probably a decade, because there will be international sanctions through 2020-21, restrictions on how active they can be on the international market. So I do think that, you know, this did impact the farm system. At the same time, if you look at the top talent they have and weigh that against everybody else, you know, they still are right there among the games elite.
So you mentioned a couple of different time frames in terms of the immediate future. Obviously, that is to be determined over the next couple of months. But 4 or 5 years or a decade down the road, I mean, how long can this team expect to be affected by these sanctions?
You know, I just think that it could be a decade, because, you know, let's go all the way to 2020-21. Now you're going to draft. You're going to sign that class. That would have been that's the last time that they have restrictions with this punishment. Within that class, you were going to have 16, 17-year-old kids that, you know, were 4 to 5 years away from the majors at least. So, I mean, just looking at it that way, now we're getting closer to 2026, 2027, to where, you know, this team is still going to be feeling the impact of these sanctions. And you think about it this way, 2016's class was basically wiped clean, you know, at least all, you know, the top signees from that season. So you're going from 2016, these 2 years where they were already in the penalty box because they had exceeded their signing bonus pool there in 2016. They were already in the penalty box for that, so they were limited already. Then you're going to have the 2 years of punishment. So they're going to have 5 consecutive years of really getting no value off that international market. So not only when you get to 2021, you're still going to be restricted on what the value you might be able to get 5 years ahead, but at that point in time, you're in the 5th consecutive year of really not having any, having gained any value within this international market. Well, you know, your competitors all were able to do whatever they needed to do within this market during this time.
Yeah, not great news for the Braves organization, but now that the sanctions have been handed down, they can move on and evaluate where they go from here. Let's talk a little bit of positive news, Mark. Chipper Jones and Andrew Jones both on the 2018 Hall of Fame ballot, candidates for the first time. Let's start with Chipper Jones. He obviously spent his 19-year career there, the entirety of his career there with the Braves. Is he a first ballot Hall of Famer, do you believe?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. I think the question is, you know, does he get 95%, or how high above 95% the ballots is he listed on? I think there's certainly one of the greatest switch hitters of all time, you know, a guy who was one of the most, you know, influential figures in the Braves being able to not only win those, extend their streak to 14 consecutive division titles, but to continue to be competitive in the years after. You know, he ranks right there with Hank Aaron, you know, Smoltz, Clavin, Maddox as some of the greatest Braves ever. And because he spent his whole career here, I think that, you know, you kind of put him right there with Hank. You know, when people think of the Braves, they're thinking of Chipper Jones. There's no doubt in my mind, you know, next summer he will be inducted into Cooperstown. And I think a decade ago we were thinking, you know, there's a good chance that Andrew Jones would have been, you know, looking at the same fate. At that point in time, he's still in the midst of 10 consecutive Gold Glove awards, and you know, you thought 500 home runs was ascension. His career took a dramatic turn, as we know. So I think that Andrew, while Chipper's a first ballot Hall of Famer, Andrew, there's a chance he gets in. I'm not going to say absolutely not, but I think basically what we're going to see is for the next decade, is people are going to be arguing, does Andrew Jones deserve to be in? I think he's going to be one of those guys that's going to sit there in that, you know, what are 35% to 50% range, and time will tell exactly how much the voters place on his defensive excellence, because, you know, offensively, he was heading towards, you know, he was going to have the numbers. But once he left Atlanta, went to the Dodgers, the years following, he just simply wasn't the same player. And, you know, with that being said, he really wasn't the same player his final season in Atlanta from an offensive perspective. I think it was one of those things where you look at all the years he spent playing center field. I think it took its wear and tear on him. I think if he had to do it all over again, he would have taken better care of himself, stayed in better shape. There, once he reached 30 years old, he just started to, the frame changed, and all the results changed dramatically enough that he went from being kind of what we thought a decade ago as a cinch Hall of Famer to now he's probably going to be looking at some of the same frustration that Dale Murphy and others have, you know, those guys that were, you know, almost Hall of Famers.
Yeah, very interesting candidacy there. Like you mentioned, rooted in his defensive excellence. So we'll have to see how that progresses as the years continue. Let's talk about a future Braves Hall of Famer and Ronald Acuna. Since we last talked, Braves top prospect takes home the MVP of the Arizona Fall League, hits 7 home runs in 23 games. What makes him such a special player?
You know, he just the 5 tools. I mean, he has it all. He certainly can. He hits for power, and, you know, we all know about all his arms. We know about the intangibles on the field. I think one thing that stands out is he's not afraid. He does have a little bit of a swagger. So would I if I was that good. You know, I don't care what to hear people say. Oh, he acts just like Bryce Harper. I don't care if I was as good as Bryce Harper, I'd act like Bryce Harper too. Maybe. So, you know, I mean, you know, you hear about this kind of stuff, this kid confident, but I think it is a genuine confidence. It's not a cockiness. I think that he knows how good he is. We saw it in spring training. He goes to A-ball this year to start the season, you know, forced his way out of that level real quickly. And as he progressed, you know, to Double-A and Triple-A, his numbers continue to improve at each level. This is a kid that it's going to be very interesting coming out of spring training next year. Are they willing to put him on that opening day roster? You know, are they want to get that clock started that time? Is he good enough right now? I do think so. You know, I think that they will – they need to make every effort to, you know, do what they can with Matt Kemp's contract, whether that's trading, eat the salary, do whatever. But I think, you know, moving forward, I think it will be good to at some point next summer, and maybe even as early at some point in April, you look out there in that outfield and you've got Ender Inciarte and Acuna and Nick Markakis. I think Nick Markakis and Ender will be good influences on Acuna. I think that there are other Ozzie Albies is already in that clubhouse. I think he's a good influence. You know, he's not much older, but it's just a little bit of a big brother type. I think that, you know, I've heard people say, you know, okay, this is the best prospect the Braves have produced since Andrew Jones. And some people say to that, well, what about Jason Hayward? I think Ronald Acuna is at a different level than Jason Hayward. Jason Hayward, there was a lot of hype, and it was warranted. I get it. But at the same time, I think at this stage, getting to the major league level, I think Acuna is at a different level than even Jason Hayward was when he reached the majors in 2010.
Well, Ronald Acuna sure has that swagger. Mark, you got a swagger all your own, man. You bring it to this podcast every week. We really appreciate you joining us. And we'll catch up next week. We'll talk a little bit more about the hot stove and all the rumors surrounding the Braves. But we appreciate you joining us today.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Take care. Hey, everyone. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Alexa Datt, and today we are talking Phillies baseball. We're going to bring in our Phillies reporter for MLB.com, Todd Zalecki. And Todd, seems like all of a sudden everyone wants to talk about international pool money. It hasn't been a hot topic before, but it absolutely is now. We know that the Rangers, Yankees, and Twins have the most international pool money, but the Phillies have about $900,000 left for the current signing period. If you were the Phillies GM, how would you fill out the Shohei Ohtani questionnaire to lure the two-way star to come play for the Phillies?
Yeah, that's kind of the hot question, and I wrote about that a little bit this week. You know, the Phillies, by all accounts, the Phillies are a real long shot here because they only have $900,000. But I do really think that that the Phillies could sell themselves a lot. You know, one of the first questions is about, you know, describe your player development, medical, athletic training staffs. The Phillies have become one of the more progressive teams in baseball. In that regard, Gabe Kapler, the new Phillies manager, is a huge nutrition health nut. And by all accounts, I think Ohtani is kind of leans that way. So maybe they could talk to him about some of the progressive things that they're trying to do. In terms of the team and why the city is a good place to play, you know, they're at a disadvantage in the sense that, you know, the Dodgers and the Yankees are certainly expected to be in the World Series last year or have legitimate expectations to do that while the Phillies are still rebuilding. But they could pitch it like this, and this is probably how I would pitch it. Okay, you know, the Phillies aren't going to be a World Series contender in 2018, but we do believe that we are very, very close. We have a really talented 40-man roster. We have a really talented farm system, and we have an ownership group that is ready to spend a ton of money. And as of right now, the Phillies only have one player, Odubel Herrera, signed to a multi-year deal. So the Phillies are really have been described by a lot of teams and a lot of people around baseball as a sleeping giant. So, hey, if you want to get on board at the ground floor and be a part of building something special, you know, maybe the Phillies are more intriguing than some of these other teams. And I would just kind of go with that. You know, again, it's a long shot, but it's a shot worth taking. I don't think it's going to happen, but I guess stranger things could happen. And it's kind of like in high school, you know, you got to write a very persuasive term paper and hope that you convince the right people that you did a good enough job on it.
Todd, I might make you some friends and some enemies with this question, but if one of the questions on the questionnaire is what's the best cheesesteak place in Philly, you would say what?
I would say John's Roast Pork is the best cheesesteak place. Now, this is, you know, it's funny. Any out-of-towner comes into Philly and automatically will go to Pat's or Gino's. Like, those are the two places they always show on TV if the Phillies are ever in the postseason or the Eagles are playing on TV or the Sixers or whatever. Those are kind of like the touristy spots, you know. It's kind of like, you know, if you would go to like the Times Square in New York and for some odd reason, like decide to get a piece of pizza, you know, on Times Square, you don't do that. Just like, you know, if you're from Philly and you're looking for a cheesesteak, you don't go to Pat's or Gino's. Those are the tourist spots. John's Roast Pork is nearby. It's generally regarded as the best. If you want to get a little bit further out of town, a place called D'Alessandro's in Roxborough is also a personal favorite.
All right, sounds good. I'm going to give Ishka Bibbles a shout-out because that's one of my personal favorites.
That's a good spot, too, absolutely.
Yeah, but I agree. Pat's and Gino's a little more touristy on that end. Are there any other international free agents that you believe the Phillies would consider if Ohtani does not work out for them?
Yeah, they're definitely going to spend that money. And, you know, the Braves just got some big trouble for Major League Baseball, so they had to release or grant free agency to 13 prospects, minor league prospects that they signed over the past 2 or 3 years. So the Phillies are going to look at those guys as well. I don't, you know, Maiton is the stud shortstop, former prospect, I guess, of the Braves. He's a guy that a lot of people will be watching. I don't know if the Phillies are going to have enough money to go out and sign him, but there's a lot of those other guys that have been released and became free agents are also very highly regarded. So if you can't get Ohtani, which, like I said earlier, is unlikely, I do think they're going to try to go after at least one or two of those Braves guys and add a little bit more depth to an already strong farm system.
All right, let's talk about some other news surrounding the Phillies. Mark Appel, the former number one overall pick, was DFA'd by the Phils. I know he's dealt with some injuries, but a lot of people were looking forward to what potentially he could become. What happened there with him?
Yeah, nothing really worked out with Appel the first 2 years in AAA. You know, he battled elbow and shoulder problems, and that kind of set him back. But even when he was healthy, he was really, really did not look like a former number one overall pick. You know, kind of all over the place, had an ERA over five in his two seasons with Lehigh Valley. So, you know, he cleared waivers and he got outrighted to AAA. So he's going to stick with the Phillies. He's going to remain in the organization. And it doesn't really surprise me in a sense that he cleared waivers and, no team claimed him, because it would be tough for another team to put him on a 40-man roster right now at this point with the Rule 5 draft coming up. With the intention of signing maybe more established big leaguers to help your roster. So the Phillies at least will have another opportunity to kind of roll the dice, and maybe they move him to the bullpen at some point, or maybe he starts again next season at AAA, and maybe it finally clicks. So I guess the Phillies are just kind of keep their fingers crossed and hope that something actually works out with him. But no doubt a pretty big disappointment at this time for the Phillies, who were really hoping that he would kind of click when he came over from that Ken Giles trade in December 2 years ago.
All right, let's give Phillies fans some good news. Any names out there on either the free agent or trade market that you believe could end up in a Phillies jersey in 2018?
I think they're still going to – well, they're going to look for some pitching help. I thought originally that it would definitely be a starting pitcher or two, and that could very well be the case, but it's not going to be a Yu Darvish or Jake Arrieta. It would be more of a Lance Lynn, Alex Cobb type of guy, under the condition that they're not looking for a 5 or 6 year deal. I don't think the Phillies are looking to give a middle of the rotation starter type of guy a 5 or 6 year deal. If they can't get one of those guys, Andrew Cashner, that type of group, can't get those guys to maybe a 2 or 3 year deal, I think then they will probably try to just load up on really talented relief pitchers, and you kind of combine those guys with Hector Neris, Luis Garcia, Adam Morgan, Edubray Ramos, a bunch of those guys that they have in the system, and kind of just do what a lot of other teams are doing. You saw it in the postseason, starting pitchers get pulled after five innings and just use the final four innings with really talented relief pitchers. So I think the Phillies, I think they feel that if they can't get the starting pitching that they want, they can load up on the bullpen and then shorten the game that way and to give them a better chance to win.
All right, we got the winter meetings coming up December 10th through the 14th in Orlando. Ahead of this year's winter meetings, Todd, give me a winter meeting from the past that stands out to you because of what it meant to the Phillies.
The one in recent years that really stands out is the winter meetings from 2010, and I believe they were also in Orlando. That's the winter meetings where the Phillies, they had won the NL East again. That was the year that Roy Halladay threw the perfect game. He threw the postseason no-hitter, but they got bounced out in the NLCS by the Giants. They were still considered one of the best teams in Major League Baseball, if not the best team in Major League Baseball. And they started to kick around the idea of re-signing Cliff Lee at those winter meetings. Everybody was expecting him to go to the Yankees or the Rangers, and during those winter meetings, that was the talk. It's going to be the Yankees or the Rangers, Yankees or the Rangers. And then at some point, I believe at the end of those winter meetings, there was some talk about a quote-unquote mystery team that was entering the picture, and that team actually was the Phillies. And I remember talking to assistant GM Scott Profrock about this, and he said he would kind of come in contact or, pass Cliff Lee's agent, Derek Braunecker, in the lobby of the winter meetings. And he said he did not want anybody to even get the faintest idea that the Phillies could be interested in re-signing Cliff. So he said he basically would just almost walk in the opposite direction anytime he saw Derek Braunecker get within 100 yards of him, because he wanted to keep this super, super quiet. So at that point, they hadn't really even talked money with Derek Braunecker. They hadn't even made an offer with Derek Braunecker, but the Phillies front office and ownership were starting to say, hey, you know what, maybe we can make this happen. You know, this is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Let's try to do it. And then about, you know, a week or so later, they ended up finalizing the deal. It was a lot of back and forth. The deal was on again, off again a few times. But in the end, the Phillies made it happen. And, you know, they didn't win the World Series in 2011, but they did, statistically speaking, put together one of the best starting rotations in baseball history and really create a lot of fun and excitement in Philadelphia sports in 2011.
Well, from all Philly fans, I'm sure their perspective right now is they hope that this year's winter meetings could be just as exciting, but we'll have to wait a little bit longer to see if that is the case. Todd, really appreciate you joining us today. We'll talk next week, and go Phils, yeah?
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Take care.